Blog Talk Radio.
Too many buttons here. I have one button and I have to press it, but man, remind me. Remind me next time I'll do better. Hello everyone. This is Masonic Effects with all the polish and professionalism that you'd expect from a fly-by-night operation. 10 years ago or 11 years ago it was a pop-up, I guess, but I didn't think the term pop-up was even a part of the vocabulary back then, but here we are. I guess we're going into more than that. We're into our 11th year, heading toward whatever comes next. And hello, how's your projects moving along? Have you noticed since we've become more adjusted to COVID, that COVID to the separations and to the dealing with this on a big scale, that the conversation was aimed at the world, and we began to look at our responsibilities much different than we had before. Academics had known, and some of the great thinkers around us, but had been talking about this. Some of what we were finding, but we can trace back to ancient Greece. I'll just give a quick nod out to the need for continuity. But I'm struck today by something that has happened recently that's underlined the benefit of continuity. Even the things that we might not find completely agreeable, but there's something about it. I'm speaking, of course, brethren, about the passing at 96 years old of Elizabeth II. She was and is a large part of my life as a Canadian who with roots from Scotland back in the 18th century landed here, like a lot of people still to this day coming to these shores for a better life. But the definition of better has changed significantly. But what I want to remind everybody is that all the complexities of a monarchy. This single woman became a symbol of courage and dedication, loyalty. Mm-hmm. In a world where leaders aren't what they appear, where it's like our politics is like a run by game show hosts. No slight to game show hosts intended, but we have this, you know, accelerated advantages of wealth that in a secular environment, this really allowed us to shed our skin from the entanglements of accountability and morality. And we can just satiate the senses. We have this, you know, this acceleration of celebrity. They don't really add anything to what's going on around us, but you know, we have minor celebrity and major celebrity, all trying to leverage that into forming credibility, to give them credibility so that people will listen to their opinion about how things ought to be handled and run. There's no reason. There's no reason. It's like authority. There's no accuracy with authority. There's no, you know, it's not like authority is an equivalent for truth. Although in some despotic minds it is. But for the people out there that are that do have a philosophical drift, we see things recurring. We see things that we thought had been dealt with before. It presses us to come to terms with when we ask these very difficult questions. What is the our nature? Are we combative? Are we tribal? Is that the state? Well, I think those kind of notions are often used as excuses. I know I've used these as excuses to explain something I don't understand. There's a great deal about us coming together that I don't understand, but I do notice that the conversation has shifted. The interrelationships of continents, of different peoples, has happened at a time when we're seeing a very large and expansive migrations of people, not only out of war zones, but because of climate shifts. We know in the history of humanity, this has been with us. We've had to move to stay ahead, to find more fertile ground so that we could form our communities and survive, have enough to eat and a shelter that will allow us to survive. So we are, in that sense, adaptive, but the sins of our fathers, we've changed. We've, for a long time, some religions have encouraged us to believe that we dominate all that is, that this creature with consciousness dominates all the lesser creatures out there. And now, well, we've gone ahead treating the environment as if it's a raw resource for us to redevelop. Only as we've been doing that, we've created some chemicals and processes in heat that's changed the environment. And we've been doing it for so long and not really paying a whole lot of attention, whether we're using, using upstream as a urinal, and then downstream we're cooking with that water. Well, we learned that one of the major changes in health has been the awareness of hygiene and water purity, really basic things. It's not that long in our history, not that long ago. Now we've accumulated, we've treated, we've seen the, you know, where you are, you look around, and there's no more, I guess we can't really say it's not happening, it's just happening. The concern is that we're, the environment is not allowing us to recover. The weather comes and goes, but, you know, that's been a focus for most of my boyhood. We talked about weather, not climate. And now the climate's not settling enough for the land to recover, for the air to recover. It's like forest fires after floods, after fires, after rising sea levels. What's coming ahead, we know it's not that we throw our hands in the air and shriek that it's, oh my goodness, what do we do? We'll face it. We'll face the reality. The projections are talking in figures of billions of people on the march, moving toward higher ground, safer ground. As the climate, it's not paying us back. It's doing what it's always done. Absorbing our lack of respect for all that is. How could we support predatory capitalism if we weren't using up raw resources? Well, there are ways. Now, we might not be able to figure in our own minds how to adjust to them. We may not be even having this conversation. The adjustment may not be feasible anymore. But we can be comforted that our premises are accurate. They're bang on. There is payback. There is consequence. We are part of this. As Pythagoras has taught the likes of you and I, there's continuity. Mm-hmm. How we break that down, you know, these thought experiments that the ancients gave us, well, don't agree with it. My goodness, don't. But at least let the explanations of the philosophers stretch your thinking before you wrinkle your nose and discount them. It's not easy. Wholesale migration of people, cutting down all the trees and letting the water run off. That's and causing floods. And that's not easy. But think you know the historic. Some of the history we've heard about the annual flooding of the Nile and what that did for the Egyptians and the people around the Nile, but even that is changing. The floods aren't there. The monsoons, some areas are experiencing rains that haven't occurred in hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. Only these rains are happening with some frequency. They're no longer the exception. They're becoming the rule. Around where I am, we have these unexpected storms, tornadoes and waterspouts have always been there, but they're more frequent. And there's less predictability about some of this stuff. Now, even with all of these advanced algorithms and satellite monitoring, there's this, I don't know, unpredictable inconvenience. Eh? It's 2022. I'm still inconvenienced about my gas fuel burning car. It's an inconvenience. My 8-cylinder from the 60s and 70s is now a 4-cylinder, and it will soon be hybrid and soon be electric. But it begs the question, we don't have perpetual motion so we're going to need to be creating energy from some source. But what about those guys way over there? What about the guys that don't really give a damn, that are still, we're facing this existential threat? That doesn't mean that the militias are going to put down their weapons and think, oh my goodness, there's something more important than politics here. We're going to have to, we'll find that we'll get there. We'll find that lesson, but we'll do it the hard way. And that's the way, definitely the way we learn. And I often think I'm limited because of my own background too. I think about the advances that have occurred. Is it Comenescu, the Czechoslovakian thinker, that had a remarkable sense of organization of education that was basically ignored, for at least from my perspective, it was ignored except for the people of that nation. The clamor for patents. We had a country not so very long ago that tried to patent the Mexican bean. It's been a part of for thousands of years, it's been part of the food base, but companies, very large conglomerates, got in there, decided that they could re-engineer this stock. Genetic modification was quite the rage at the time, and then would have the temerity to expect that they could patent it, so they could profit from it. One day I suspect we'll profit from somebody selling us clean air. We'll be sucking oxygen or some version of it, I'm sure. But in the midst of all of this is the potential to live a good life. These things have always been there, but as you think about the potentiality, in what, 8 billion years, our star will become a red dwarf. Yeah? 8 billion years. Oh, horror. Does that mean that, that the future is not what I want it to be? We'll adapt. And how? I have no idea. We'll see if we can get out of this century and the next before we start to hurl our motifs at the bigger questions about what does this mean. Well, we're already rethinking that. There are the collision of faiths is not so much a collision. People are finding a sensibility within themselves to respect the practices of other people. So there's boundaries. And there's a public space, and as long as nobody interferes in that public space, you can practice as you choose, then we're good. But what's come up in out of the corner of our eye is something that, my goodness, the organization had tried, our structures, our estates had tried very hard to eradicate. We even created a whole new vocabulary to describe the evil inherent in them, paganism, call them pagans, and came up with these notions of hell and devil and sin and that type of thing. But in the periphery, we have a pantheism that's I don't know if I could say it's come on or whether it's always been there, but it's surfacing without any fanfare, without any clamor, without proselytizing. And people are gravitating toward it, often very, very discreetly. And we see a growing curiosity, because we want to know, do you whatever your practice is, do you have answers? Do you have an understanding that will soothe, will admonish? You know, I need something to hold me accountable, and all of us, I'd like to think, need to be held accountable, and we need some force that intimidates our governments to legitimacy. Because unless they're intimidated, they just float along, exploiting, you know, becoming very self-serving. But there is this group that are now, the vote, the clamor isn't the clamor. It's that people are just pulling back the most. They found the power, withdrawal. You don't like the systems. They don't represent you. Don't vote. Don't represent. And the question becomes, academics will already be ahead of this, but what to do? Because that kind of behavior, we know, destabilizes nations. Even these lovely social experiments we call democracies. Yeah. Very, very much so. The status quo is changing. Is it, you can wonder, and you can help me, is this paradigm shift? I would like to think that we can handle that kind of thing, but paradigm shift usually comes because of a perception of creativity. And we're going to stop there and try and be as creative for you today as we have ever. At the end of this show today, I'd like you to have some encouragement, some reinforcement that your ideas are bang on, that you have some skills that you know, whatever you're reading, of course, my worldview is that masonry requires reading, and read and read and read and read, and don't say anything till you've studied. You don't. That's your privilege to be the entered apprentice. And whoever told you that you needed to compete to be a somebody, they lied to you. They lied to you. Our ritual teaches us what humility is about. And I've asked, as you go through the program today, I'm going to ask you, how in the world do we, and I mean this in all sincerity, how in the world do we go about our business if we're not bringing any, ought not to bring any attention to ourselves, to explain what we've done, what we will do or can do? No fanfare, no bragging. No, we don't do things because we want a pat on the back or our photo taken. Taking photos makes us a commodity. No, but to do things because they're the right thing to do. To do things and function as a moral human being. That's not convenient. Certainly not compete. How do we do that? All of these projects, you and me, we are each individual projects within the sphere of our own life, and we're part of these lodges, which are, you know, really, really interesting projects, and they're complex, and a little more complicated than we tended to make them where I am. So collect all those pictures of the beautiful, beautiful libraries and lodge rooms and these inspired atmospheres. And remember that as we're progressing and what we create is going to be in very good company one day. Here, speaking of good company, check this out. This is Bill Evans. kind of intoxicating, I find. Bill Evans. Here. Listeners. New Zealand. China. Yeah. Turkey. Sudan. Ethiopia. Pakistan. Iran. Oman. United Kingdom. Ireland. USA. Latvia. Canada. Thanks for tuning in. Good to have you sitting in, pulling up a chair. Here's a commentary for you, making music. If you've ever seen a child discover what a musical instrument can do, you understand the amazement that happens when a person discovers Freemasonry holds a similar potential for us to do something that feels beautiful. That pursuit can become the work of a group who respect ability, imagination, appetite, conviviality. If we sound this good alone, imagine what we could do sitting in with others. It's only overwhelming if you aren't respecting your potential. Maybe you won't be a concert soloist. Maybe you'll be a member of the chorus. But you are part of something exceptional without ever intending. Your love affair is with atmospheres created by sounds. Admittedly, Masonry does indulge a variety of tastes, knowing so well there is a time and moment for all of it. Some muse about the artistry, pageantry, celebration of the human spirit. Others find themselves swept away in a swirl of frisson, in a conversation taken up by composers and musicians long ago in a far-off place who are still able to touch hearts whenever their music is heard. How far along the metaphor you go is not obvious to anyone until you notice it yourself. We can quickly pick out themes in our ritual, collaborations, mathematics, harmony, unexpected outcomes, dedication, unending progress, smooth. When we master our craft, we learn sharing it with the world holds unexpected reward. How we react to acclaim, it can and does define us, but greatness contains modesty, familiarity, frailty, sincerity, qualities that distinguish us. It takes metaphor to bring us together in the soundscape of Masonry. So when we attempt to reinvent, it's all good until we find we've unexpectedly lost something in the translation. Even those forays into the imagination serve a purpose. Can't tell what you'll find until you go there. So definitely, brethren, find the music in you. Find the music. Nobody can take that away from you. Thank you. Busy Hands and the keyboard, Yoko Miwa Trio. Just a talent. If you're looking for that kind of energy, it's just lovely, lovely. That was her trio at with Will Slater on bass and in Regatta Bar in Cambridge, Massachusetts, back in 2017. I want to share some ideas to the poet today. Is a favorite of a lot of people, William Wordsworth, and he I've showcased his work on the show from time to time. Always coming away with this sense, and as I've become older, I have this sense of how courageous poets are, and whether we appreciate them day by day, which I think some of the fortunate, those fortunate do, the less fortunate seem to be waiting for someone or something to motivate them. That's never going to happen. The inspiration comes from within. And how to inspire you to achieve and open your thoughts? Well, that's your responsibility to you. Nobody's going to force you or make you a better person or cause you to grow and develop a different way of thinking or change your loathsome kind of understanding of yourself, you know, the mediocrity that lives in our minds is there, and it's just taken up permanent residence. No. Earlier in the commentary, I was talking about awareness of environment, what's going on around us. And I want to fill this in a little bit as a lead up to the poem, the title of this is Lines Composed a Few Miles Above Tintern Abbey. And this Wordsworth wrote the 13th of July, 1798. And it opens with the speaker's declaration that 5 years have passed since he last visited this location, encountered its tranquil, rustic scenery, and heard the murmuring waters of the river. And what does it take for waters to murmur? It's like water in a ditch, eh? No, it isn't. He recites the objects he sees again and describes their effect upon him. The, quote, steep and lofty cliffs impress upon him thoughts of more deep seclusion. In other words, the five senses are alive, just as they are with you. Not so long ago, I had a fellow, very bold, self-assured fellow, telling me that men don't show emotion. and I did the same thing. I laughed. I'm not well brought up. I just laughed. Nobody has that luxury. Nobody. We experience all of them. How we express them, that can be quite interesting. But our senses are alive. They're like little feelers. You know, they just draw in information, often far more information than we are processing, because we've come up with, instead of thinking through, we come up with opinions. We just draw a line under all that cumbersome thinking and all those calculations, and we just insert an opinion. Stop thinking too much. Just throw out an opinion. And of course, things go off the rails when we do that, because that's like our internal ideology. This is the way I am. I'm silly. I embarrass myself with my temper and I make a fool of myself, but I don't see that. I don't see myself through the eyes of somebody else because I can't really, but I can appreciate a small piece of that. That doing what I do makes me seem like a fool, and nobody's going to tell you and I that when we sound like a fool until we figure it out ourselves. You already know. And this isn't like, oh gee, nobody told me. Come on, this is reality. Wordsworth is interesting because this poem, particularly Lines Composed, is I am told. He was deeply concerned about our increasing estrangement from our surroundings. So where we pick that theme up is in Genesis 1:28. For those who have the Hebrew Bible or the be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth and conquer it. Be masters of the fish of the seas, the birds of heaven, and all living animals on earth. Don't we talk about that as if we have some power, not a responsibility? It's not like, we just take out a riding crop and whip all of these creatures and whip the lambs and just demand and extract what we can. If you've ever been around old farmers, you know that's not the way. You know that there's relationships with the land and the atmosphere, the rain, the livestock. It's caring. It's caring and it's respect. And back in the day, this poem reflects Wordsworth's respect. He tells us that he learned or taught himself to look at the natural world differently. Like a prophet or a seer, Wordsworth had come to experience a presence which he would not call God, because the West had too limited an understanding of the divine. I would say that's still accurate. Instead, he uses the word something, pointing to a reality that he will not, indeed cannot, define. This comes from a short article by Karen Armstrong entitled "Heaven on Earth: Our Ransacking of Nature is Destroying the Planet." And he begins to make sense. Now, begins to make sense because he's telling us about us. If not whether we agree with this, but here he's leaning into the detail again and saying, look, here are the detail, and what do you think of it? Assumption. And I have felt the presence that disturbs me with the joy of elevated thoughts. He leans against the dark sycamore tree and looks at the cottage grounds and the orchard trees, and the fruit still was unripe when he was there, and he sees the wreaths of smoke rising from cottage chimneys between the trees, and he imagines that they might rise from vagrant dwellers in the houseless woods or from the cave of a hermit in the deep forest. Poem has a speaker. The speaker goes on to describe how his memory of those beauteous forms has worked upon him in an absence from them when he was alone or in a crowded town and city. And they provided him with sensations sweet. Even the present moment, the memory of his past experiences in these surroundings floats over his present view of them. And he feels bittersweet joy in reviving them. And I wonder, was he having moments of reflective nostalgia? Not that restorative stuff, oh, gee, you know, let's go back and rebuild the 50s. As soon as the hands of my watch go backwards on command, then I'm with you there. No, this is reflective. He's reflecting. The time is now past, but he does not mourn it. He says, nature made up his whole world then, waterfalls and mountains and woods, and gave shape to his passions, his appetites, and his love. We have that. I have a good old friend who constantly dwells on childhood, the better days, the innocence, the freedoms. Little people are less, have their own level of sophistication, but by comparison to the weight of responsibilities and what that does to a man after the end of a life, childhood is simpler. Tintern Abbey is composed in blank verse. So do we relate to what he is saying to us, or do we reject it because it's not something that we can find within our own vernacular? It would be interesting if we all be odd if we all thought the same and had the same reaction to have the same reaction to his thinking. But he does give us a moment to think, doesn't he? To relate to these ideas. Well, let me plunge into a little bit of this for you, and then you can see. 5 years have passed, 5 summers, and with the length of 5 long winters, and again I hear these waters rolling from their mountain springs with a soft inland murmur. Once again do I behold these steep and lofty cliffs that on a wild, secluded scene impress thoughts of more deep seclusion and connect the landscape with the quiet of the sky. The land is come when I again repose, here under this dark sycamore and view these plots of cottage ground, these orchard tufts, which at this season with their unripe fruits are clad in one green hue and lose themselves mid groves and copse. Once again, I see these hedgerows, hardly hedgerows, little lines of sportive wood run wild, these pastoral farms green to the very door, and wreaths of smoke sent up in silence from among the trees. With some uncertain notice, as might seem of vagrant dwellers in the houseless woods or some hermit's cave, whereby his fire, the hermit sits alone. These beauteous forms, through a long absence, have not been to me but as a landscape to a blind man's eye. But oft in lonely rooms amid the din of towns and cities, I've owed to them. In hours of weariness, sensations sweet, felt in the blood and felt along the heart, and passing even into my purer mind with tranquil restoration, feelings, too, of unremembered pleasure, such perhaps as have no slight or trivial influence on the best portion of a good man's life, his little nameless unremembered acts of kindness and of love, nor less I trust to them I may have owed another gift of aspect more sublime, that blessed mood to which the burden of the mystery, in which the heavy and the weary weight of all this unintelligible world is lightened, that serene and blessed mood in which the affections gently lead us on, until the breath of this corporeal frame and even the motion of our human blood almost suspended, we are laid asleep in body and become a living soul. While with an eye made quiet by the power of harmony and the deep power of joy, we see in the life of things. If this be but a vain belief, yet, oh, how oft in darkness and amid the many shapes of joyless daylight, when the fretful sir unprofitable in the fever of the world have hung upon the beatings of my heart, how often in spirit have I turned to thee. Oh, Sylvain, why, thou wanderer through the woods, how often has my spirit turned to thee. That's about a third through. Does it work? When we're distressed, do we have those beautiful thoughts? Do we have the thoughts that come back to us that we can retrieve and that we embellish with the way that we describe it? Oh, you might have a glass of wine, and some people, some professional drinkers, will just chug it down for the effect. Others will savor it. We'll swirl it, we'll hold it up to the light, we'll take in the odor. It becomes an occasion. It's like standing over the golf ball on that early, with the early morning dew still around and the mists being burned off by the sun as it comes up. And being in that atmosphere, and maybe some deer coming out of the edge of the woods around you, and making that putt. And do you remember it? How many years later, silly old man? Or sitting in the theater when something impactful happens, and it's happening in your mind, and you feel your emotions welling up. And then shaking your head, puzzled, how is it, this work is a couple of hundred years old. How is it still? And looking around, there's not a dry eye in the place. How does that happen? How did he know? Good question. I know. I'd like to let that run out in this full time. It's a beautiful piece of music, Basin Street Blues. Just, and the performance, you know, these are, this is a guy, Keith Jarrett, that's just into his music. And he shares it. I find those things very courageous. Very courageous. Our bit of history today carries on looking at the impact of English masonry in the continent, particularly around Utrecht and Amsterdam. But here we've reached beyond that a bit, and the period that we're talking about is still 18th century, you know, 1770. And if we learn quite a bit from the contrasts and different practices. Not so much do we hear that there's a clamor about for dominance. And I would ask you, is that how you think that harmony occurs, by an effort to dominate the conversation, to be, there's only one right voice in the room, and it's been written out in scripted for us? Can't imagine that. We're handed, in a sense, calculations. Masonry is the calculus of life, eh? Here, in the 1770s, French Freemasons began to delineate the society of vulgar men where there is idolatry and tyranny. And what we're talking about is a contrast. And I erase this without being facetious. Ought there to be a greater tension between the profane world and the lodge? Why would we ever begin to accommodate the profane world in our practices? Wouldn't that just be diluting the product, diluting and making, trying to pass this on to people who have no inclination, and they haven't done any of the readings and absorbed it and struggled to learn? That the struggle is a big part of, it's a significant part, not in and of itself, but we all make the commitment, and we get, it becomes a, gradually it becomes a self-discipline. And not everybody can do it, and not everybody will do it. So why would we, I have to wonder out loud, why would we ever attempt to accommodate that? The lodges, as they say, will frighten the soul and imagination of the profane by substituting a regime made to please reason, made for the interior of our hearts, because such a society would affirm the exercise of social virtue, banish the prejudices which tyrannize the vulgar. Oh, isn't that a beautiful way of putting it? Banish the prejudices which tyrannize the vulgar. The profane should only be admitted to our breast when brothers have tested the openness between them. In the 1770s, it was as if these lodges were at war with the profane. Clearly, this originally imported term has been given a new and indigenous meaning. A French language Masonic almanac of 1773 declared that banishing in our assemblies the sex enchanteur, that is, women, shows that the joy and pleasure of the senses is not the point of our association, were but one example of the profane. In the same period, Dutch Freemasons said that it was the vulgar, not the Freemasons, who foment civil disorder. And they claimed that the vulgar are the same people who persecute the order. The term derived conceptually from the English and Scottish guilds, and had always embodied the notion of the outsider. Among Scottish Masons, a cowan. Originally, the word had meant another craftsman who might be a competitor for wages and labor, but not a member of the local guild. In medieval times, women could frequently be just such competitors, although their membership in certain guilds was also not unknown. In the early 18th century, however, the term lost all such practical and economic associations among Freemasons. Its meaning was purely social and cultural. Where we can tease out its implications, we find that it distinguished Masonic morality from the non-Masonic, the ideal from everyday reality embodied in the profane who practiced the antithesis of Masonic virtues. As one English writer known to the Grand Lodge put it, the profane in early Christian times were those from whom the creed was hidden, having been rendered into a secret note, mark, or token by which the faithful of all parts of the world should interchangeably know and be known. The creed was not to be orphaned or profaned or divulged. The possession of secret signs delineated the righteous or separated believers from the world. In a ritual recorded in Amsterdam in 1757, the candidate for the degree of entered apprentice is asked, in what place was the first lodge formed? The answer, upon a mountain, inaccessible to the profane, where a cock was never heard to crow, a lion to roar, or a woman to babble. Never seems to be a right time to end the program, and I know we're sorting through ideas here, sorting through an understanding, and many of the things that is shared in Masonic effects are not revolutionary, but we put together combinations of thoughts, and they seem to make sense. So, I validate them by looking at what kind of feedback I get from you, from listeners, from readers. It's we should, I think, be able to enjoy the results of our efforts without expecting that everybody around is going to agree. If you understand your motive, if you know that you're working with an idea that came to you from Kant or Descartes or Hume or Aristotle, most of what we do finds its way back to the work of Aristotle. If that's the case, then we're walking that ubiquitous path quite lost in our own thoughts, indulging ourselves with the joys around us. We don't have to accommodate or answer to people. We don't seek that for validation. We ask the the tougher question of ourselves, the rightness. We find the rightness by not guessing at it, but finding consistencies. Oh, I guess it would be easier if we were all mathematicians and lined up to get into Pythagoras' school. But I think it's not just the least. I think it's important for us to understand why these themes are important in Masonry, and to understand for ourselves why they're included. What's the purpose? So pick one. Sometimes they're by name, like Pythagoras and Euclid and Solomon, and other times they're by inference. So in particularly in ritual, there's a great deal of inference. And we're told this, we're told that that the messaging here is through metaphor. So surely we realize there are many different ways of understanding, but we have a right to our own opinion, but certainly not to, as Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the senator, United States senator, said, we don't have a right to our own facts. So if we're going to be a judge, you want to be the judge and dominate everything, then surely you begin with the basic framework for a Mason with understanding. Nobody said this was easy. I hope to see you again next week, and I trust you've enjoyed the program, and I've tried to make it as entertaining as I can. How do you do that? I'll leave you with the sound of Dizzy Gillespie. Wish you well. And over the next couple of days, we're going to see the state funeral of the Queen and the presence of a new king. And life will go on. Bye. Come back.